Now I'd like to go ahead and welcome our main speaker. We have Rose S. from Thousand Oaks.
Good evening, everyone. I'm Rose, and I'm an alcoholic. Thank you so much for asking me to come out and letting me be of service here tonight, because that's what this is all about, giving away what we were given. So I'm going to do my best to share my experience, strength, and hope with you. I'm going to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now. You know, I have a memory, you know, about a few years ago, I woke up, and I had this memory from when I was 5 years old. And when I was 5 years old, my parents allowed me to decorate my room with, they had a painter come out and put Dr. Seuss characters all over my walls. And I fell in love with this room because I love Dr. Seuss. And next year, they decided for some reason, right after doing this, that they were going to add a second story onto our house. So they had to tear down my bedroom to rebuild the second story. So I was devastated. And after they had removed the roof, and I was in another room at that time, they, you know, there's a lot of time going by, and for some reason I woke up in the middle of the night wanting to see my old room. And I went into that old room to see my Dr. Seuss pictures, and I remember looking up through the opening in the ceiling and looking at the stars, and I remember, in a way that only a five-year-old can ask, asking, who am I? Why am I here? I grew up in an alcoholic home where there was a lot of violence, sexual abuse, and verbal abuse, and it was really scary. So as a five-year-old asking that question, I forgot it almost as fast as I asked it, because I was not allowed to ask such questions. I was brought up Jewish, and any time I would ask questions about God, my parents never knew how to give me the answer. They would just talk about the religion part of it, of ritual and holidays and how we're supposed to look to others to be religious and Jewish, and how important Judaism was. And yet on the inside, it was a horror story. The next memory I have, I was thinking about, you know, when was the first time I ever tried alcohol? And the first memory I have is when I was 8 years old, and it was one of our Jewish holidays, and the Manischewitz flow was, you know, wine was flowing. And it was interesting. You know, the Manischewitz bottles, if you've ever seen them, they look very much like grape juice bottles. You can't tell much of a difference. My uncle thought it would be really cute to see what would happen giving me some Manischewitz wine. He just poured me some. And I can remember that first moment, that first sip of that warmth going down, hitting my stomach, and the warmth that came over my body. And I felt like I have to have more. Even at 8 years old, I was begging him, more, more. And he's like, no, no. And then jump forward, the next memory I have of drinking is I was 11 years old, and I developed early. And I was at my cousin's wedding, and a lot of alcohol, and I was wearing this really beautiful dress, and I felt really sophisticated and grown up for the first time, but I was terrified and shy and like, you know, like, what's going on? There's a lot of dancing and grown-ups around, and I didn't know what to do, but I saw everyone drinking, so I just was like, oh, everyone's drinking. I'm gonna go to the bartender, and I'm gonna order drinks, and for some reason, he was giving them to me. So I'm out on the dance floor, and I'm dancing, and I'm having a great time, and I'm feeling free for the first time in my life. And I was feeling like, oh, this is what's going to solve all that bad feelings inside. I just need to have this wonderful medicine. I'm going to get this as much as I can, because I just feel free and alive and a part of. And I thought I was the most amazing dance person on the floor. But then the next thing I remember is waking up huddled in a fetal position under the appetizer table. And my family scooped me up, and they asked me that question, which I often heard later in my family. Do you remember what happened? Yeah, I was dancing. I was, you know, I was life of the party. They said, no, you were the talk of the party. What did that mean? First time, incomprehensible demoralization. Apparently, I was taking my clothes off at 11 years old on the dance floor. So, as time went on, I became, you know, there was a lot of abuse in the household, and one of the ways that I used to cope with that is I used to cut on myself, and it was as if the tears I couldn't shed was the blood that was flowing from my body. I didn't know how to feel. If someone told me it was okay to cry, I didn't know what they were talking about, because in my family, I was told, if you cry, I'll give you something to cry about. So I held everything in. My grandma, my mom's mom, she used to tell me I was the seed of Satan every time I misbehaved. I was adopted into this family. I had three older brothers. And I was told that if I didn't behave, they were going to send me back. So I learned really fast that I needed to conform to how you wanted me to be so that I could be safe. My whole childhood, the only time I ever felt safe was when I was sick. For some reason, when I got sick, I felt love and I got attention and people were really nice to me. I got flowers from my dad. And I didn't realize till many years later that I subconsciously held on to that form of attention, that I liked being sick, and I wanted you to acknowledge, I'm sick, I'm suffering, love me. I'll get to that part of the story later. So I'm 15, and I have a boyfriend, and I'm out of control because, you know, when you grow up in an alcoholic family and your feelings are held in all the time, you know, once you start doing drugs and alcohol, all of a sudden, it's like an atomic bomb going off. At least it was for me. And all those things I felt and all those things I wanted to say came out of my mouth. And it came out often. And my mom was afraid for her life because I took a butcher knife one day and I threatened to kill her. I cut my wrist one time and apparently it's frowned on at camp. And, you know, I never cut into the veins because, again, it was all about, I'm suffering, I'm sick, give me attention, I'm hurting. And I had to show it rather than say it because I have to hold everything in. I can't tell you that there's bad things happening in my house. I have to show you. So I cut my wrists and I went they took me into the nurse's office. And they wiped it away, and the blood, it stopped bleeding. And the nurse was like, oh, you could try a little harder next time. I said, okay, I will. So apparently it's still frowned on, and they did put me into UCLA psych ward because it was an attempt. And while I was there, it was the first time counselor came in, and she came in with a sheet of paper, and she put it in front of me, and it was the first time that somebody presented to me things I needed to work on. In Alcoholics Anonymous, we call that character defects. In the psych ward, they call that personality defects that you need to work on. Apparently, my personality defects I thought were my assets, but, you know, being sexually provocative, self-abuser, suicidal ideation, pathological liar. I said, wait. Okay, yes, I get that. What's this pathological liar? What is that? And she said, it's somebody who believes their own lies. And I said, no. I don't lie. And she said, exactly. Took me many years to get that one. Not till I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, that's for sure. Because again, I was always trying to be who you wanted me to be. So I graduated from the psych ward, and in ended up in a girl's home. And apparently, they decided to put me in a girl's home in Hollywood. Why they decided to put me in a girl's home in Hollywood, I'll never know. But I thought I'd arrived. Hollywood. And it was really scary at first. You know, when I went there, there were only 3 girls from the psych ward and 27 girls from juvenile hall. And I had never been in jail. I was from an upper middle class Jewish family. I thought being a Jap, a Jewish American princess, was, you know, an asset. Apparently, people who are from juvenile hall don't think that's an asset. They think that's a reason to beat me up all the time. So I decided really quick. Remember, all I want to do is make sure you like me, because I don't even like me, but I want you to like me. So I'm going to do whatever you want me to be so that I will be liked and approved of. So I became the drug dealer of the place on Hollywood Boulevard, and I became very popular very fast. And would go out to Hollywood Boulevard and do the incomprehensible, demoralizing things to get drugs, to bring them back so that I could have friends. And never thought there was anything wrong with that, because in my family of origin, that was normal. I was sexually abused and getting attention that way, just I didn't even think anything of it. To me, I liked having power. My power was taken away from me when I was young, so I was going to get my power back the way that I lost it. I was going to manipulate you in an inappropriate way so I could get what I want. Some people would think I was being taken advantage of on Hollywood Boulevard, but I always felt like I was taking advantage of them because I was getting free drugs. And it didn't feel inappropriate at the time. And that's one of the things we learn in Alcoholics Anonymous, is those things that we thought were okay, we realize the stronger our conscience becomes, and when we do this work, we begin to understand and forgive ourselves for the things that we had done that we know now are not okay. Not to shame ourselves or to beat ourselves up, but that we can understand that we can heal and we can transform our lives to become the people that God intends us to be. So while I'm there, you know, I'm beginning to realize I have these two parts of me. You know, I'm in therapy and they're trying to help me, and I'm telling them about what's going on in my home. And then my dad comes in and says I make up these stories, and remember, I'm the pathological liar, so, and I do lie a lot and I'm caught in lies, so people are not sure what to believe about me, even the therapist, because I'm just a different person every day depending on who I'm around. So there's, you know, at one point they thought I had multiple personality disorder because I was just so many different people. But what had started to happen is I started to have these two sides of me. I had this one side that was that 5-year-old asking that question, who am I? Why am I here? And then I had this other part of me that wanted to be who you wanted me to be. And I didn't know how to live in those two worlds. So I had to separate them. In therapy, I started to learn how to be. I started to ask the questions, who am I, why am I here? I was never given the tools of how to apply that or to find that out. But I was at least honored, and it was presented to me that there is such a thing of like you can do something with your life. You don't have to be like this. I just didn't know how. So I ended up going to a junior college, and I was like, I need to turn my life around. You know, I know what I'm going to do. I know what's going to turn my life around. There's this guy over there. He gets straight A's. He's a square. He's a good guy. I'm going to start dating him. And you know what? I'm going to become a good girl. I'm not going to drink as much. I'm not going to do outside issues as much. He's going to straighten me out. He's going to be my knight in shining armor. And you know what? He thought he was going to be my knight in shining armor too. That's why there's Al-Anon. So we started dating, and, you know, it didn't help. You know, I kept drinking. I kept doing outside issues. And I thought, okay, I know it's going to fix me. If I get married to this guy, I'm going to become a wife. I'm going to become a good person. I'm going to stop drinking as much. And, you know, never I'm going to stop drinking. It's just I'm going to stop drinking as much. And my life's going to turn around. It's going to be good. We're going to have a good, stable, you know, life. So we got married. Got drunk all the time. Went into blackouts. The disease is progressing. But I'm delusional. You know, I'm a pathological liar, even in my own head. That's what it means, you know, you believe your own lies. So time goes on, and I go, okay, I am still out of control. I know what's going to fix me. I'm going to have a baby. I'm going to be the mom I always wished I had. It's going to be the best. I'm going to be stable. I'm going to be sober. And you know what? My whole pregnancy, I stayed sober. It felt really good to stay sober my whole pregnancy. I white-knuckled it. It didn't feel good. But you know, all that obsession I had for alcohol, I threw into becoming an obsessively perfect mom. I went to parenting classes. I was studying, you know, how to become a preschool teacher. I was going to be like this amazing mom. And you know, and I was. It became this beautiful fairy tale of just doting on her and loving her. And it was the most, I had never loved a human being as much like this before in my life. It was beautiful. But this disease does push-ups in the parking lot. And I was a dry drunk. And one day when my daughter was 6 months old, I was restless, irritable, and discontent. And I heard some ruckus out by the pool. And I go and I look out and I see some teenagers out there. I can't see very good, but I can see and I can smell the pot. I'm like, ooh, God, does that sound good right now? So I go down and my babysitter is with her friend smoking pot. Now, so we're talking about normal people. So normal adults, responsible adults, would probably go tell the parent of the babysitter, you know, your daughter's smoking pot by the pool. You know, and probably never let her babysit again, right? That's normal people, right? No, no, no. My babysitter became my drug dealer. And I was off and running again. The love I had for my daughter, the commitment I had to being the most amazing mom that I always wished I had, could not keep me sober. I tried over and over again to get sober again, but the periods of time of sobriety were getting less and less, and my drunken episodes were getting more and more, until one day I'm driving drunk. And I remember getting in the car and putting her in the car seat, and the next thing I remember is waking up in my bed, not knowing how I got home. And I ran into her room, and she was asleep in the crib. And I fell to my knees, and I thanked God that she was safe, because I do not remember getting home. My husband comes home that night, and I said, I have a problem. I think I'm an alcoholic. He said, no, you're not. I said, no, really. I am. I need help. I'm going to go to AA. Because I had heard, you know, when I'd been in the girls' home, you know, AA came and visited us, you know, and I knew about it from different friends of the family who would occasionally tell me maybe I might have a problem. They didn't know anything at that time, but. So I went to AA. And while I was there, you know, it's not enough for me to just admit that I'm an alcoholic. I need to focus on everybody else and what they need to be working on in their life, too. If I'm going to be healing, everyone around me has to heal, too. We need Alitot, not Alitot. Hey, maybe. I'd never heard about this before, but while I was there, someone told me about Al-Anon. So I come home, I'm super excited. I come home, I have all this paperwork this big for my husband. Usually it's the other way around. The Al-Anon comes home with the paperwork for the alcoholic, right? So I come home with the paperwork, and I put it into my husband's lap, and I said, there's a place for you too. He was not as excited. But you know, darn it. He started going to Al-Anon and he was working a better program than me. How dare he? What step are you on again? But you know, I like to do the kind of AA program where I don't have to look at my part. You know the kind? Like, you sort of get a sponsor and you know about the steps, but you go to therapy and you work on your childhood trauma. You talk about what they did to me over and over again, spiraling, spiraling, spiraling down into the pit of despair, and you're wondering why you're miserable. You're wondering why you're miserable in AA. You think it's the AA meetings. You think there's something wrong with you guys. You guys are eating too much sugar and drinking too much coffee. You're complaining too much, whatever. I started looking at all the differences in AA because I wasn't willing to look at what I wasn't doing for myself and my life to transform me. So I was looking at what was wrong with all of you, because I was eating organic now, I was doing yoga, I was into health, becoming really spiritual, I was meditating, didn't need AA anymore, thank you very much, working on my inner child. Which is okay. There's nothing, I mean, I do that now, but without working on my side of the street, there's no hope for me. If I'm still looking at what they did to me, I will never be free. And I don't know at what point of resentments that are building over and over again are going to be the cutoff point to send me into drinking again. I don't know when that'll be. But the day did come. And I drank again. And I only drank for a day at that point, and I did laundry. I don't know why. And I went to a meeting right before that, and I said, I'm going to drink today. And they're like, okay, you know, good luck. And I did. I only drank for a day, and I came back the next day. It was awful. And it just proved to me, in my head, in my pathological liar mind, that AA didn't work. Because I wanted to believe it didn't work, so I had to prove it didn't work so I could leave. Because I didn't want to look at myself. So I went back to my meditating and my yoga and my perfect organic eating. And I was homeschooling my kids because, you know, I'm anti-establishment because nobody's allowed to tell me what to do. God forbid the preschool needs to tell me something. So, I don't have enough time to go into those stories. And I stayed sober for a while after that. It was probably a year or two. And my husband and I like to go to Inn of the Seventh Ray, this place in Topanga Canyon. And they have a lot of organic food. And, you know, many times we'd gone there and they'd come by and they'd say, oh, do you want a bottle of organic wine? And we'd usually say, no. This night, they came by and said, yeah. And my husband was still going to Al-Anon. How dare he at this time? I don't know why he was still going to Al-Anon. I wasn't going to AA. It was supposed to be like a decision together. But he was still going to Al-Anon. And he did that Al-Anon look that, you know that one, the Al-Anons who are here. By the way, welcome to all the Al-Anons for coming to the AA meetings. I'm always so enthralled and full of joy to see Al-Anons come and participate in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's such a beautiful thing. So thank you so much for being here and participating in our sobriety. So I was sitting there and I said yes to the bottle of wine, because, you know, it's certified organic, it's natural, it's not going to harm me. And So my husband does that Al-Anon look. You know, I don't know if you know that look, but he sort of like crosses his arms and he's like, huh, tilts his head a little bit to the left. And then he says, I said, I'm just going to have one glass. He said, I remember somewhere something about like alcoholics don't know how to have just one glass. I said, I'm not an alcoholic. He said, oh, and he was beautiful. He worked his program and he said, okay. He didn't say anything else. Good for him. You know, he practiced his program. Oh, I can't cuss in here, can I? Okay, anyway. I'll hold back. You get what I was going to say. But anyway, so I drank my glass, his glass, and the rest of the bottle. Because I'm an alcoholic. And my disease does push-ups in the parking lot. And it's waiting for me to drink again. And we were supposed to have a beautiful, romantic weekend away from the kids for the first time in a really long time. And the last thing I remember is drinking that bottle and waking up at the end of our vacation and not remembering any of it. I swore, okay, that's it. I'm not going to drink anymore. I'm going to just meditate more. I'm going to fast. I'm going to cleanse. I'm going to be healthy. Just threw myself into health. I'm going to homeschool my kids more. We're going to play. And you know, I have to say, there's something fun about being a driven alcoholic sometimes, because one of the things that about having a drive to become a better mom is that we did have a lot of fun together, and working on my inner child, it was really fun. I used to finger paint with them and we'd have gardens. And so, I mean, there was a lot of fun times with my kids growing up. Unfortunately, they grew up with an alcoholic mom who was like a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And my son referred to it a little bit. You know, where there were times where my kids didn't know who they were going to have that day. Was I going to be the stoned, drunk, out of control mom who's raging and kicking holes in the wall? Or am I going to be all sweet and loving and gardening with them? Not only did they not know, I didn't know. Because every morning I would wake up determined to stay sober. But I was not going back to AA. I was not. Because you guys were trying to tell me I had some kind of part in my childhood, and I said, no, I didn't. And you tried to tell me I lived in my victim story, and I got high off of it. And I said, you don't know what you're talking about. Don't you know how they wronged me? How could I ever forgive them? And they said, forgiveness is a gift you give yourself. And I said, I can't cuss, but I said, F you. To several sponsors. God love them. I got fired many times by many sponsors. I was not easy to work with. I was rebellious because I thought I had all the answers. Don't you know how hard I studied child development? Don't you know how hard I studied psychology? Don't you know how hard I work on my childhood? Don't you know how much I spend on my therapy sessions? I had to justify everything just so I didn't have to look at myself in a real way and be accountable for my own actions. Didn't matter. It didn't matter at what cost, and it didn't matter how much I hurt you. Don't tell me what to do. I got this. As I'm crawling off of the toilet for the umpteenth time. So time goes by, and the periods of sobriety get shorter and shorter, and my periods of drinking get longer and longer. And, you know, there was a period of time in my drinking early on in my drinking career where I could stay sober. Like, I could drink for a period of time and then quit. No problem. But as time went on, it was getting harder and harder to get sober. And it was scary So I said, okay, I know what the answer is. Medical marijuana had just come out, you know. My kids were now becoming teenagers, and it was really stressful in the house, you know, and one more time, look what they're doing to me. No longer was it my family of origin, it's like my teenagers are making me crazy. Don't want to be accountable for what I'm doing to them. I am only now looking at how stressful and how out of control my children are and how they're affecting me. Because I'm so selfish and self-centered, I can't comprehend that I have wreaked havoc in this home and caused damage. I cannot see it. So I get my medical marijuana card. And I'm not going to drink, but I'm going to take my medicine. So I went on the medical marijuana maintenance program, doing my meditation, my yoga, eating organic. Instead of one smoothie, I'd have three, you know. And, you know, but then I started having, you know, anxiety from smoking so much pot. So then I needed, you know, Xanax. You know, I started throwing in all the outside issues had an interesting little apothecary mix going on. I was making my little apothecary marijuana butter, my tinctures, and I thought I was living the life. I thought, you know, I've got this, you know, I'm feeling so peaceful, except for there's men on the roof trying to kill me, but... And the government's planted a chip implant in my brain, but I'm casting them out. And I'm telling my son, don't look at the computer when that red light goes on, because they're watching you. Remember that? But I'm okay, because I'm taking my medicine. It's doctor prescribed. Sorry, I had to laugh. I cut myself. Okay. So, you know, and then I'm drinking again, of course, because I'm an alcoholic, first and foremost. And I started drinking every single day, 24 hours a day, without stop. And I had never done that before. And I was completely gone. I was completely delusional, unable to cope with life. Lost my mind. There was a time, apparently, I believe it's true, I trust my husband, I hear stories. Apparently he was driving one time and I tell him that they're zapping us from behind, the government is following us, and I jump out of a moving car going 40 miles per hour because I have to escape the zapping. Apparently I ran home. There were many incidents like that. Some are not so funny. Summers, that incomprehensible demoralization, saying and doing things that you would never want to do in front of your family. A day and a time came where I hit my last drink. You know, by this time my son was using also, and we used to check up on each other. You know, like I'd be checking on him when he was doing drugs, and he'd be checking on me when I'd be drinking. And one day he's pounding on my door and I'm in the bathroom thinking I'm hiding my alcohol and drinking in private. And he's like, I know what you're doing in there. And I'm like, you know, I'm spilling the alcohol all over the place because he startled me. And no, you don't, you know. And I don't know about you guys, but I was one of those drinkers. I'd always start off measuring. I had a little measuring cup and I'm like, I'm only going to have 4 shots of vodka. For me, that was one drink. It didn't count if it wasn't less than that. So I'd be measuring and doing my 4 shots. And because, you know, when you're drinking every day, when you become tolerant to alcohol, and you need more and more to get drunk. So I needed like 4 shots just to get a buzz. So so he's pounding on the door, and I quickly, you know, try to clean all up, and I go out there, and I don't know about you guys, but you know there's certain words you gotta avoid when you're too drunk to say them? Yeah. right? So you have to scan your mind and less is more, right? Certain words you just cannot, you're going to slur them for sure. You know it. So he's like, you've been drinking all day. I hear you drinking every day and I've been hearing you throw up in the bathroom. And I said, nope. I can't say any more than that. So, the next morning, that entire quart of vodka was empty. I assume I drank it, I'm not sure, but I don't remember anything else after that. I woke up and I went into the shower and my son referred so eloquently, once you go to AA, it's in your head. It's in your head. And that morning in the shower, you know, the first time I had come to AA, I had no problem admitting I was an alcoholic, but I had a really hard time accepting I was an alcoholic. I didn't want to be an alcoholic. I wanted to drink. I wanted to drink, have one or two. I wanted to enjoy drinking. I wanted to go back to feeling that feeling I had on the when I was 11 years old on the dance floor and free. It was my medicine. It's what helped me cope with life until it didn't. And so that morning in the shower, I heard in my head, I am powerless over alcohol and my life has become unmanageable. And I felt it. And I knew it at my core. And I fell to my knees and I begged God to restore me to sanity. I got out of that shower and I went to an AA meeting that night. And I was really terrified that I would never get my mind back. I was really scared. I was really delusional. I was really edgy. I knew I couldn't drink anymore, but I wanted to go on the medical marijuana maintenance program. Because don't you know I have anxiety? And then my son overdosed, like he shared about. And it was in my face. It was in my face. We were in a session in his program, and he told me with the therapist, he said, I'm supposed to be telling you this. He's making me tell you. I've been stealing your pot and selling it to all my friends. And I made a decision that day. You know, his counselor who passed away like a year or two ago, such a great guy. He pulled me aside after that session and he said to me, you know, you have an opportunity here. You are either going to be the example of sobriety in your house or you're not. And your son is watching you. I went home that night and I threw everything away. And I made a commitment to never take anything else that affects me from the neck up, no matter what. And I didn't know how I was going to do that. And I only knew that I had to. Because remember, I want to be a good mom. And I don't want to die. And I don't want my kids to see me die. So that was the hardest 2 weeks of my life. I was still delusional. I was coming out of my skin, coming off of the pot. And I thought I was going to have to go into a psych ward, but I was really afraid. I was terrified. I didn't trust the medical community. There was a lot of reasons why I don't trust the medical community. One of them was when I was in the psych ward when I was 15. I don't have time to get into that right now, but I also was like, if I ever tell them what's in my head, they are never letting me out. So I went to a meeting and I was one of those that cried a lot and babbled a lot. You know, be patient with those guys. They can get better. Just be patient. And, so one guy said, you know, pain is our teacher and fear is the touchstone. I'm saying it backwards. Fear is our teacher and pain is the touchstone of growth. And that's in the 12 and 12. And he went on to explain what that meant. And it was like a seed that was being planted inside of me to be sprouted later to grow. And then another guy shared, God is either everything or he's nothing. He either is or he isn't. And I just let that seed be planted and let that sprout and grow. So I made a decision. I wrote God a letter and I said, I'm going to do whatever is required of me in AA. I'm going to do my part and I'm going to trust that you're going to do your part. You know, and I didn't trust God because, you know, I was told by my grandma that I was a seed of Satan. And I thought I was born evil. And I thought there was no hope for me. And I had tried all kinds of religions to save me. And none of them did. Because I wasn't being accountable for my actions. Again, it was the religions, blaming the religion. But that letter that I wrote to God, and I love what Josh shared about how he found God of his own understanding about the breeze. And in that letter of writing to God and asking for his help is when I discovered who God was. It wasn't so much in his answer, but that I was asking the right question, finally. I had been asking the wrong question all these years. I finally was asking the right question. God, show me. In that letter, at the end of the letter, I said, who do you want me to be? Who was I born to become? I was that five-year-old again, asking that question. Who am I? Why am I here? Show me. I'll do my part. You show me. What is it that you intend for me to be? I woke up that next morning. I had the best night's sleep of my life, and God had restored me to sanity. I was not delusional anymore. I wasn't shaking anymore. I had clarity of thought. I was at peace. It was a total miracle. I completely surrendered my will and my life over to the care of God at the core. Now the work began. I started to get really uncomfortable. These interesting sensations started happening inside of me. They're called feelings. So I got a sponsor. I started working the steps. And when I got to my fifth step with my sponsor, there were two very powerful moments in my fifth step. You know, when she came to hear my fifth step, she said to me, she said, is there anything in your fourth step that you didn't share that you need to get off your chest? Any secrets you need to unburden so you can be free? And I remember getting hot all over. And I knew there was these secrets that nobody knew, these horrible things I had done. And I felt safe with her. And I told her. And I was expecting like, you know, but she just, in her sweetness and her wisdom and her own connection to a higher power, she said, thank you for sharing that with me. And as I went into my fourth step, you know what I was talking about before, about how am I going to forgive those who'd wronged me? The reason I'd been avoiding AA and doing the work all this time, I was on the fourth column about those who had molested me and wronged me. And I understood, because in my fourth column, I said I was being in my victim story, and I was replaying these situations over and over again. I understood my part, but I didn't understand, how do I forgive those who wronged me? I know about the poison story. I'd heard it 1,000 times, like, you know, resenting someone is giving someone poison. Oh, I never can say it right. But taking, thank you. So, and I knew what that meant, but I didn't know how to forgive. So she says, you know, that what you told me right when I came to hear your fifth step about those secrets, do you remember how unconscious you were and disconnected from God? Do you remember what that felt like to be unconscious like that when you had done those things? I said, yeah, I can feel it now. The shame, the regret, the emptiness. She said, those who have wronged you live like that all the time. But you know what it's like to live differently. You know what it's like to be close with God now. They don't have that. And for the first time in my life, I cried, not because of what they had done to me. I was crying with compassion for their suffering and their emptiness and their not knowing God. And I was free. I was free. There's another story I want to share with you. There's two, and one is about my son. When he was in rehab, I was pulled into a therapy session, and my son proceeded to tell me about all the harms I had done to him. And I was only 6 months sober myself. No, I was a year and a half sober myself. But I had done a lot of work on myself already. And when he started to share this, he was crying. And he said, "Mom, I was terrified of you growing up." And I said, "My anger was never your fault. It was never okay for me to be like that. And I'm sorry. That's not the kind of mom I want to be. I want to be a different kind of mom today." And we embraced. And the therapist came to me after and he said, "I don't see this." He said, the fact that you have honored your son's feelings and given him a space to bear his pain will allow your family to heal. But I think it's really important for you to understand that there was a moment for that. Because there's a moment to be firm with our kids and to hold boundaries. But we have to be sensitive to when they're vulnerable and to take in that moment and embrace it and get out of ourselves so they can heal. The other story I want to share is about my daughter. My daughter is in Al-Anon. She's my first child. When I did my amends to her, I was 3 or 5 years, 3 to 5 years sober. And I thought, all is good. You know, God, I've made amends. I'm like cleared. You know, I'm such a good person now. I felt really clean. And one of the things I had said to her in my amends, you know, one of the ways that we make amends is we say, we don't just say we're sorry, we're mending our wrongs, meaning we're making a commitment to change our behavior with you in the future. We're not going to harm you anymore. And one of the ways that I harmed my kids was I used to try to make them feel guilty for my pain. And I made a commitment to no longer do that. I was not going to make my children feel guilty for my pain anymore. And I made that promise. So one day, you know, the whole family's all excited because she's going to go and speak in Al-Anon. And I'm all excited to go hear her. And, you know, and I say, "Oh, I'm really looking forward to hearing you tonight." And she said, "Mom, you're not invited." And I got that feeling in the pit of my stomach. You know, like, didn't feel good. And there was this moment of clarity when I realized, and there's the time in my life before this moment, and then there's the time after this. And I'm going to close with this. I know we're about over here. And the time before that, I used to make people responsible for my pain, and the moment after this, I no longer did. I went up, and I felt my feelings without her seeing. I cried. I was mourning the loss of not being able to go. But I also honored her timeline for forgiving me. It is none of my business when my children are ready to forgive me for the harms I had done. And I was able to separate it. I honored my feelings. It didn't feel good not to be invited, and I felt it. I honored her timeline for when she was ready to forgive me. And I went down with a clean energy. And I hugged her and I said, "You have a beautiful share tonight." And I meant it without any energy in it. And she said, "You know, Mom, I'm really sorry. I'm just not ready." And she said, "But maybe another time, maybe another time." I said, "It's okay. No, really, I want you to have a beautiful share tonight." And then the last thing is, during my amends, backtrack real quick. One of the things my daughter said to me, she said, "You know, I'm really glad you're sober, Mom, but I want you to know that you will never be alone with my kids." But I kept on staying true to my amends. I kept on doing my living amends. I continued to not mistreat her. I honored her. I gave her space. And slowly our relationship began to heal. And she, 3 years ago, asked me to be there for the birth of her daughter. Miracles do happen in Alcoholics Anonymous. No matter how far down the scale you have gone, you will see how your experience will benefit others. And I hope that my experience has helped you tonight. Thank you.
Let's give Rose another round of applause. Powerful.